WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our guest, Sekou Sundiata, is a poet, performer, and one of the fathers of the spoken word movement. Greg Tate wrote in The Village Voice, "Sundiata is to contemporary African-American poetry what Marvin Gaye was to modern soul." Sundiata has a one-man show about the period when he had kidney failure, dialysis, and a kidney transplant. Toward the end of 1999, after his transplant, he was on the way to his comeback performance driving through the snow in New England when his car slid off the road and he broke his neck. He spent the following year recovering from surgery. Fortunately, he has no paralysis or disability. He says his show is a personal look at the world from a forced withdrawal, an exile from the self he had come to know. His show is called Blessing the Boats, and he's been performing it off and on for 3 years. His health is good now, and he's currently performing Blessing the Boats at the Apollo Theater in New York through April 10th. The title of his show is taken from a poem by Lucille Clifton, who also had a kidney transplant. Terry talked with Sekou Sundiata in 2002. He began with an excerpt from Blessing the Boats.
This is from a section called The Part That Hurts.
Here I am, a middle-aged brother with the shakes who can't stay awake, who has to hold on to the wall because his head is spinning like a gyroscope. A poet who can't make poems because there's too much distance between his mind and his body. And anyway, his mind is so slow and confused that ideas just bounce around and reverberate like a sound effect. Where's my witty? Where's my sovereignty? And most of all, where the hell is my cool? I was no longer the self I thought myself to be. How do you just wake up one day and not be who you think you are? I'll tell you how. The body is a low-down, dirty sneak. It remembers every physical or psychological insult it ever suffered. And each insult leaves a scar. And that scar is a map to the insult that just lays in the cut like a memorial. And should you delete it from your memory, your body will retrieve the data and bring it back up just when you're trying to go to sleep. Or just when somebody tells you that you're cute. Or just when you tell yourself how cool you are. Here comes the big payback. Your body will break you down. It will make you beg. It will make you change your priorities. For example, I was surprised to find out the size of the kidney. The kidney's job is to regulate a delicate balance of chemicals and minerals and water in the body. They clean the blood and regulate blood pressure. Big job, big organs. Simple as that. But most kidneys are the size of a small fist, and they're located in the back, off to the side. I had taken it for granted that the most important part of the body was located front and center. This is what I mean about the body being a sneak. It'll let you believe things like that until it's ready to tell you the truth. It ain't the heart, or the lungs, or the brain. The biggest, most important part of the body is the part that hurts.
Sekou Sundiata, I really like this piece a lot. Why did you want to do a performance about your period of medical crisis?
Well, you know, first of all, in writing this piece, it is written in a way that is very different from the way I write. I don't write in a really personal way or an obviously autobiographical way. The first thing that drove me to write about this was my experience of going on dialysis and needing a transplant. I was on the transplant waiting list, which, you know, can be anywhere from 2 years to 5 years or more for some people. And during that period of time, five of my friends came forward and volunteered to be donors, to donate a kidney. And, you know, we went through the whole process of tissue typing and blood testing and all of that. And four out of the five people were found to be a match. It's very unusual, very rare, especially for people who are not related. And, you know, I was moved by that personally. And, you know, to me, it was a story that it just had so many implications to it in terms of what I call grace. The idea that for me, I couldn't have done anything to really earn anybody's kidney. Yet here were these people coming forward, volunteering to put their lives in jeopardy to save mine, essentially. So I was really driven by that this to me was just some unearned grace that is a always compelling story.
This is a very different kind of story for you in several ways. As you say, your things aren't often personal in that sense. And also, A lot of your stories are about somebody who's very mythic in a way, very cool or very revolutionary or very much about romantic love or risk-taking. You're writing sometimes about being African-American in America and what that means. And this is about being vulnerable.
Yeah. Yeah, no question. The experience of having what's called end-stage renal disease and not knowing for quite some time, I'm talking about 3 years or more, 3-4 years, really what was wrong, you know, thinking that the symptoms sometimes can be some of anything. You know, there's a cluster of symptoms that can relate to a number of different things, and they're easy to excuse, especially if you're living a very busy and active life, which is what I was doing at the time. I felt by the time I was diagnosed with having renal failure, it was a new way of thinking about myself and a new way of thinking about my body. You know, I grew up being very active, being a amateur athlete, running, playing sports and all of those things. And all of a sudden, my body would not do what I wanted it to do, you know, when I wanted it to do it. So it was a whole new way of being vulnerable.
How did you know something was wrong?
It's a good question. Well, you know, the things I felt was fatigue, tiredness, I was yawning all the time, frequent urination, those kinds of things. And frankly, you know, at the time I was very busy. I was touring with a show around the country, and I thought these things were due to being just tired and worn out, to traveling so much. You know, at one point in the piece, I talk about, you know, being in cheap hotels, lousy venues, breathing recycled airplane air, all of these things, you know, that we generally talk about when, I guess, when we get a general, being generally run down, which is how I felt. But what I noticed is that other people would feel the same way. So, I would say, well, you know, everybody I know is tired and run down. But they would recover. You know, they would rest for a week, 2 days, whatever, and recover. I could never recover. So it was almost as if there was this long-running flu that was trapped in my system. That was the first clue. The event that triggered it is I was having breakfast with a couple of friends in a restaurant one morning, and they told me that my face had broken out. I had these tiny bumps all over my face. We finished breakfast, and I went straight to the doctor, and, you know, the doctor examined me, gave him a urine test, and he called me the next day to say that there was something in the test that indicated my kidney function wasn't right. So I went to see a kidney specialist, a nephrologist. That's when I found out that at that point, my kidneys were at 50%.
What was your initial way of dealing with being sick? Did you push yourself? Did you become more self-protective?
No, not really. My kidney disease, we suspect, was brought about by hypertension, probably long-term undiagnosed high blood pressure. And when I got that diagnosis from the urine test and I saw the nephrologist, basically I began blood pressure, hypertension medication. And so I was really trying to really stay with that. And then I started exercising and eating better and doing those kinds of things. But after about 6 months, I really, like many people, I had an aversion to the idea of having to take a pill every day. So I started slacking off. I take the medicine every now and then, and et cetera, et cetera. So I still wasn't convinced that that this was really as serious as it was. Even though the doctor said my kidneys were at 50%, there was the belief that any further deterioration could be halted once the blood pressure was brought under control, and that, you know, I could live a life at 50% kidney function.
So did people start reacting to you differently once you became weaker?
I didn't really notice a difference then. I noticed a difference actually after the transplant. People pretty much reacted the same to me even when I was on dialysis. I think that had to do with the form of dialysis that I was on, which is called peritoneal dialysis, meaning I didn't have to go to a hemodialysis center every week. It's something I did myself. So I maintained a lot of my strength, and I looked, actually, I had more vitality, even in the way I look, than before I went on dialysis. Some of my health returned. So there wasn't much of a reaction there, but once I had the transplant, I don't, you know, people, I guess people are very suspicious about organ transplantation and disease and all of those things. So yeah, people seeing me after the transplant, it kind of triggered something about their own mortality.
Sure.
You know, so I recognize that some people backed away. You know, some people kind of lost contact. And it's a sense, it's very difficult to put my finger on it because nobody ever says this outright. But for some people, not all by any means, but for some people, there was a sense that they had given up on me in some way.
Sekou Sundiata, speaking with Terry Gross in 2002. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2002 interview with poet and performer Sekou Sundiata.
There are two ways of getting a new kidney if you have kidney disease. One is to get a kidney from somebody who has just died, who was an organ donor. And the other is to get the kidney from somebody who you know, who is willing to undergo surgery and donate one of their kidneys to you. You took that second route. Did you think you were initially going to go the other route of getting it from an anonymous organ donor?
Yeah, I was on the transplant list, and I was on the list for about a year and a half, and I had no intention of asking anyone for a kidney. That was another part of it. I just couldn't imagine asking someone to give me a kidney. In fact, the nurses who looked after me when I was on peritoneal dialysis told me that I was the first patient they had who never asked them for a kidney, and you know, I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that somebody would just ask, especially essentially a stranger, for a kidney. So in my mind, it was settled that I would be on the list until I got that call saying that, you know, we have a kidney for you, come to the hospital. But a couple of my friends said just at first casually that yeah, I would give you a kidney. And, you know, I kind of just said thank you at first. But, yeah, it was they mentioned it more than one time and wanted to talk about it seriously and wanted to know what it would take. And then finally it sank in. And, you know, I realized that, you know, these people were serious and they would really go through with the testing. And if they were a match, would donate, you know, donate their kidney. And, you know, again, these are unrelated. These are friends. These are not blood relatives.
So who are the people who made the offer?
Well, one is the woman that I love. I call Kazi, and she appears in the piece. The others are friends. You know, just two people were friends of hers who became friends of mine. You know, the longer we knew each other, one person is a long-term friend that I've known. Her name is Sydney. I've known her for about 25 years. The other two people were two men named Bill and Claude, and then my close friend and manager, Katia Stitt, turned out to be the one who was the match, and turned out to be actually they were all matches, but she turned out to be the donor.
Why her? Why not the other people?
Well, since four out of five people matched, and we had discussions about it. Basically, over dinner, we would go out and have these great—
For all of you, the whole group?
Yeah, we would call them transplant dinners. We have these great dinners with great food and, you know, wine and laughter and everything, and we would talk about the transplant. And finally, we all went to get tested together. And when the results came in, we had another meeting to talk about what to do since, you know, all these people matched. And basically, they ranked themselves. They decided that Kazi, who was the only one with a child, would be fourth, because she had a child, and there was some concern about that. Claude, who had some medical issues of his own going on, was ranked third. And then Bill, who was in good health and older than the rest, came in second. And Katia, who was in good health, the youngest, volunteered to be first. And then everyone else volunteered to be backup donors in case anything went wrong for any of us. You know, and to me, that was just remarkable. And whenever I would tell people the story, even before the transplant and after the transplant, whoever I tell that story to was really just moved by it. And so I thought that, you know, there's something in this story that is just beyond me. It's great, much, much greater than me. And it does speak to ideas about love and friendship, but also just about unearned grace.
It must seem like a real impossibility of repaying such a debt. You know, what can you do that measures up to somebody giving you their kidney?
I don't think you can do anything. You know, I really don't. And, you know, I would ask I asked each of them, and especially Katia, since she ended up being a donor, you know, what can I do? You know, what could I possibly do? And, you know, being the people they are, everyone said, well, you know, just get healthy, get well, et cetera, those kinds of things. In my own mind, I thought that, you know, as a writer and a storyteller, I thought maybe what I could do is tell this story. You know, I've talked about this before. I come out of a tradition of testifying and witnessing, whether that was in the church or, you know, in literature or whatever. And that the idea that in these testimonies that there is great value in these stories. And sometimes you can't really see what the value is, you know, at the time that you're doing it or telling it, but you sense that there's some great value in the story. So if anything, I mean, I don't think of it as repaying a debt because I don't think that can be done, you know, but it is what I have to offer. I've been given this story, and I think that it may be useful.
You were preparing for a comeback concert in New England, and you were driving to this concert, you know, after you had gotten healthy enough following your kidney transplant to start performing again. You're driving in a snowstorm through New England to get to this comeback concert, and you were in a car accident and broke your neck in the car accident, and from my understanding, you nearly died in that accident. You were trapped in the car for a couple of hours. What was going through your mind when you were in that car with a broken neck after having just gotten through this horrible period of kidney failure, kidney transplant, post-kidney transplant surgeries, finally recover, and then you're in this horrible accident?
Well, my first thought, I mean, even as the car was sliding, you know, in the snow, was how absurd this was. You know, it just seemed stupid to me. First of all, this happened in January of 2000. I had my last surgery related to the transplant in December. I don't even know if it was a full month before the accident. So I was still in a sense recuperating from that. So I thought that was, you know, I was putting that behind me when this whole thing happened. And I remember thinking as the car was sliding off the highway that I just couldn't believe it could all come down to this. You know, it just seemed like such an absurd and silly thing, you know, to happen. And then also, I have to tell you this, you know, I think that there's no question that my life was in danger. I didn't know that my neck was broken while I was there, you know, upside down in the snow. And I didn't think anybody could see that I'd gone off the road. But I never felt that I was going to die. You know, I never felt that was it. And I don't know, there's no physical evidence to support that idea because it was a blinding snowstorm. I dropped down a slope. You could not see me from the highway. And I couldn't even hear the car, the traffic on the highway passing by. So I had no real evidence to support that. It was just a blind faith that I had that somehow this was not it. At the same time, I'd never been so alone and isolated in my life. And I don't think I never knew things could be that quiet either. And then this woman shows up, kneeling beside the car in the storm, and she has a cell phone. And she starts talking to me, and she calls 911, and, you know, she gets all of that going. And by the time the fire department arrives, this woman is gone. I never see her again. I don't know her name or any of that, but she's just gone. And from at that point on, you know, the fire department has it, and they cut me out and all of that.
Did you have any idea before all this happened to you that people could be so good, so decent?
Yeah, I did. I did. You know, and really, it's a case of knowing something for quite some time, and then something happens and you get to know it at an even deeper and more profound level. I've been fortunate in my life to just been helped and assisted by so many people, both people I've seen and then people I haven't seen, but I know that, you know, people have helped me in various ways. And, you know, I've had just an example of many, many examples of this kind of goodness. Having said that, it didn't diminish in any way the fact that this was seemingly out of the blue, you know, and very mysterious. I mean, she showed up and then she was gone, you know. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think that's fundamental in the human heart, you know. And I think it's probably more common than we may perceive on a day-to-day basis.
It's really lucky and amazing that after breaking your neck, you didn't end up paralyzed or partially paralyzed. You got your full movement back, right?
Yeah, it's remarkable. I started while I was trapped in the car. First thing I did was wiggle my toes and, you know, try and wiggle my fingers to see if I had function. Yeah, I was very, very fortunate.
Sekou Sundiata speaking to Terry Gross in 2002. He is performing Blessing the Boats, his show about his kidney failure and its aftermath, at New York's Apollo Theater through April 10th. Coming up, author Marilyn Robinson. I'm David Biancooley, and this is Fresh Air.